the NPR News Update for Thursday, August 21st. I'm Phil Picardi. Today on the podcast, we enter the state fair. Minnesota's kids still above average on a college placement test. Judging the economic value of a proposed northern Minnesota mine. Doctors embrace social media. And we hear about a really big, really healthy meal in St. Paul. First, the Twin Cities Archdiocese reached a clergy sex abuse settlement yesterday. Peter Cox reports.
54-year-old John Jaker says he was sexually abused when he was 11 years old by Father Thomas Stitz. Jaker was an altar boy at St. Leo's Catholic Church in St. Paul. The financial terms of the settlement were not disclosed by either side. It is the Archdiocese's first settlement reached under the Child Victims Act, which allows child sex abuse victims who are now over 24 years old 3 years to file civil suits. Jaker's attorney is Patrick Noaker.
The Child Victims Act has opened the door for many people to be able to come forward and tell their stories. They're very unfortunate stories like John's, but they needed told.
Bishop Andrew Cousins told NPR News that the settlement will be paid with several sources, including insurance. Stitz died in 1985 at the age of 50. More than a dozen people have accused Stitz of sexually abusing them as children in the 1960s and 1970s. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The University of Minnesota is wrapping up the first phase of its building security program. Alex Friedrich has more.
The U began securing buildings in February after last fall's spike in crime on and near the campus. On Monday, it restricted access to more than 50 buildings on its St. Paul campus using a card security system. Next week, it will do the same with its West Bank office building. At that point, the U will have more than 140 buildings with fewer hours of public access and tighter security in the evening and on weekends. University officials say they'll focus next on securing tunnels and skyways. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The gates at the State Fair open this morning. The fair runs through Labor Day. Our Tim Nelson was there when it opened, along with the clouds, which opened. He talked with Kathy Werzer during Morning Edition.
How was the opening this morning?
It was very wet. There were about 50 people up at the entrance up here. They got in, and it just poured here for about half an hour. I was coming back to the booth here, and the water was running over my shoes in the street. So we're off to a very wet start. But, you know, last year, I think the first 5 days, the average temperature was 92. So maybe this cool weather's a little nicer.
All right. Well, now the fair, as you know, is famous for the food. What's new this year?
Well, there are 28 new foods on the grounds this year. I was counting them up with Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine's Dara Grumdahl the other day. And we could actually only find four new things on a stick. Now, the things that really kind of stick out this year are breakfast foods. There's a breakfast Juicy Lucy, peanut butter and jelly French toast, and stuffed scones. But there is a deep fried breakfast with cheese and sausage and egg and Canadian bacon, and that is on a stick, Kathy.
Mm-hmm. I feel my arteries clogging right now just hearing that. Now, I know that there is something called the West End Market, and this is new. Where exactly is it, and how does it look?
It's over just north of the Midway. The thing that really stands out about this is it's some of the most open space on the fairgrounds here. It's got a beautiful open plaza and a pretty sizable amphitheater. It's got two giant new restaurants on either side. Lulu's Public House and the Blue Barn are open today. Now, they follow O'Gara's at the Fair and Mancini's Alfresco, which opened last year. You know, that's part of a trend we've seen of some pretty substantial and permanent investments here at the fair, as the fair sort of moved away from longtime traditions like church diners.
I'm a big fan of church diners. You know, I also understand that there are some, this area that you're talking about has a major new entrance. So kind of explain that to us,
too. Yeah, they're calling it Supergate. It's a new 10th admission entrance to the fair. It's got the huge bus yard in front of it. It's where all the park and ride and express buses are going to be dropping off and picking up passengers. That means there isn't going to be mobs of people crossing Como Avenue on the south side of the fairgrounds here. You know, that can just turn into absolute gridlock when the 4-H'ers are moving in and out. And you might remember there was an accident out there in 2010 when a truck knocked over a power pole and hurt two people. So if what the fair says is right, it's going to move about 500,000 of those people up north of the Midway now. And, you know, about a third of the 1.7 million people that come to the fair come on transit, and they're going to be coming into that gate now. The other thing you'll notice there is there's a giant new ticket building there. Fair officials say they're starting to put some of the infrastructure in place for internet ticketing. You might soon be able to get in with your smartphone like you do at the airport, although fair manager Jerry Hammer told me they're not quite ready for that yet.
And this whole area is where Heritage Square used to be.
That's right.
Okay. What else is there new to see at the fair this year?
Well, there's some changes at the Coliseum that I know will be near and dear to you. The fair is rebooting its horse shows, mixing up breeds and styles, and adding some new competitions. There's also a new extreme canine stunt dog show up at the North Woods. That's where the lumberjack shows are.
Thank you, Tim Nelson.
You're welcome.
Tim Nelson, Kathy Werzer on the NPR News Update. Governor Mark Dayton was at the fair today, along with other politicians and would-be politicians. Dayton has said that he will wait until Labor Day to start really campaigning for his reelection. But he did talk with Tom Scheck about his agenda. And Tom has this report.
When Mark Dayton ran for governor in 2010, he said he wanted to improve the state's economy, spend more on schools, make the tax system fairer, and end the cycle of recurring state budget deficits. 2 years ago, Dayton followed through by raising income taxes on Minnesota's top earners. He used the money from the tax increase to balance the state's budget, fund statewide all-day kindergarten, and increase spending for schools. During this year's session, Dayton pushed for a $1 billion public works construction bill, and lately he's been taking a victory lap to promote some of the projects it pays for.
This is a great day for Mankato and for Minnesota State University Mavericks. There you are.
Last week, Dayton was in Mankato for the groundbreaking for an expansion of the Mankato Civic Center. Dayton said the public works projects, the new Viking Stadium, and other business subsidies helped lower the state's unemployment rate.
This is a crucially important project for downtown Mankato, and as the regional capital of this part of Minnesota, it means it's important for the region, it means it's important for the entire state.
4 years ago, Dayton campaigned by barnstorming the state, visiting 87 counties in 87 days. This year, he said his day job has curtailed his campaign time. Instead, he's using public events like the Mankato visit and the Bully Pulpit to highlight his agenda.
My campaign theme was a better Minnesota, and we have a much better Minnesota today than we did when I took office.
Dayton is hoping voters agree with him. The 67-year-old is running for re-election for the first time in a career that includes one-time stints as state auditor and U.S. senator. And if he's re-elected, he says it will be his last term in office. Dayton says a top priority for a second term is improving the state's current and future labor force. He said he's committed to spending more money on education and that he wants the state's colleges and universities to better prepare students for work. Dayton said the focus on the labor force is necessary to ensure highly skilled older workers can be replaced when they retire.
We have to find a way for the sake of everybody in Minnesota, as well as for those individuals, to get that lined up.
Dayton's Republican opponent, Jeff Johnson, says the governor's tax policies have put Minnesota on the wrong path. On the night he claimed the Republican nomination, Johnson told supporters he'd put a check on government spending and tax increases.
I have a vision of a state where politicians understand that taxpayers work really, really hard for our money, and we treat it just as carefully as though it's coming out of our own pockets, which ain't happening in St. Paul right now.
Dayton said the tax hikes Johnson is criticizing helped pay for important things like job training and economic development. He said Johnson should spell out where he would cut spending if he rolled back the tax hikes. Dayton also said Minnesota's economy is doing better than many other states. And as for future tax hikes, Dayton says he's reluctant to push for them.
I don't have anything right now that I would do. I think we need a period of stability in our tax system.
Republicans have also criticized Dayton for approving $89 million for a new office building for the Minnesota Senate and for the botched rollout of MinSure, the state's online health insurance exchange. Dayton said the building is a part of an overall capital renovation to accommodate legislators and the public. He said MinSure's rollout was problematic, but it's doing better. Dayton said he intends to run a positive campaign, but he also said he's going to point out where he differs with his opponent. He said Johnson would push for a budget that cuts government spending, stops a minimum wage increase, and rolls back tax hikes on top earners.
The kind of things we suffered through for a decade before I arrived are going to come right back at us. And I think people will see that that's not in their best interest.
Both Dayton and Johnson will have plenty of time to highlight their differences over the next 75 days. Dayton has committed to debating Johnson six times before Election Day. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota's high school students are tops in the nation once again in ACT scores. Minnesota students also scored high on benchmarks that indicate they're ready for college. But big gaps remain in test scores and college readiness between the state's white students and the state's students of color. Tim Post reports.
This was not the first year that Minnesota students did well overall on the college readiness exam. For the past 9 years, they've posted the highest average overall score among states where a majority of students take the exam. This time it's 22.9, a tiny slip from the previous year's score of 23, but still nearly two full points higher than the nationwide average. 36 is the highest score you can get on the test. Minnesota Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius is happy with the results, but says more work remains to be done to improve the results of all students.
Certainly we're proud that we're number one in the nation, and that's important, but we'll be much more proud when every single one of our students earn a high school diploma and are ready for college or to go right into the career.
The latest report on ACT scores shows a continuing gap between white students and students of color. In Minnesota, white students scored an average of 23.7. The average for black students was 17.9, the lowest average among non-white test takers. There's also a gap in overall college readiness between white students and students of color. 44% of white students met college readiness benchmarks in English, math, reading, and science, but only 10% of black students hit those benchmarks. Caselius says a new effort starting this year aims to improve college readiness for all students. Students will take tests in 8th grade and 10th grade to see if they're on track to take the ACT. Then all Minnesota high school juniors will take the full ACT for free in the spring. Last year, 76% took the test. The exam will replace a series of tests students were required to pass in order to graduate in recent years. Caselius calls the switch a game changer.
Because it sets the expectation that every student has to have some level of post-secondary in order to earn a living wage in the future and to be ready for a really good career.
Larry Pogemiller, commissioner of the State Office of Higher Education, says the new testing protocol is intended to get more students thinking about what they'll do after high school.
You know, that doesn't necessarily mean a four-year college. Could be a two-year or even a certificate program. But that it's likely that something beyond your high school diploma is going to be necessary.
Pogemiller says helping students, especially students of color, better prepare for college isn't something that should start in the final years of high school. He says a push by the state now to get more kids into quality preschool education and have them reading at grade level by third grade will pay off years later when they take those college readiness tests. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A proposed underground copper mine near Ely would employ about 850 people and process 50,000 tons of ore every day for more than 30 years. Those are some of the details released in a pre-feasibility study out yesterday about the proposed Twin Metals project near the southern edge of the Boundary Waters. Twin Metals joins PolyMet and several other companies looking to mine copper and other minerals in the region. Reporter Dan Crocker talked about the internal study with Stephen John last night.
Well, it shows that Duluth Metals feels pretty good about the prospects for its Twin Metals project up near Ely. The company told analysts and investors in a call this morning that the project would have low operating costs, it'd have steady profits, and they estimated revenue of around $12 billion over the first 10 years of the mine. Twin Metals they're looking to mine one of the largest untapped deposits of copper, nickel, and precious metals in North America. So they're predicting mining nearly 6 billion tons of copper over 30 years, and they say there's potential to even go many decades beyond that. So they say there's some pretty significant economic upside here.
Dan, did they release more details about what the mine would actually look like?
They did. This would be one of the largest underground mining projects in the country. The mine entrance would be near the Ely Airport, that's about 6 miles from town. And from there, an underground road would slant down more than 1,500 feet underground underneath Birch Lake. Twin Metals officials, they've described it kind of like an underground city with lights, water, air circulation, you know, everything you would need to support a workforce of over 800 people working 24/7 underground.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, and the ore would be crushed underground, and then a concentrate would be produced at the surface that would be piped to a facility near Babbitt. It'd be a significant operation. You know, by comparison, PolyMet, which is the proposed mine that's up near Hoyt Lakes, would process about 32,000 tons of ore a day, and that compares to 50,000 tons at Twin Metals. So it's a significant deal.
Now, critics of the PolyMet proposal have raised concerns about potential water pollution. I got to believe this is the same concern with Twin Metals.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anything, that concern is even magnified among environmental groups because of Twin Metals' proximity to the boundary waters. And the main concern, again, is that these minerals are found in sulfide-bearing ore, and that when that interacts with air and water, it can create sulfuric acid. And the fear is pollution could potentially flow into the boundary waters. Now, Twin Metals argues that their plan does offer some environmental benefits. For example, they say that they plan to backfill 55% of the tailings left over from the mining back into the mine. So they say that, but opponents say underground mines do have a record of pollution as well. And in addition, Stephen, opponents are also raising some safety concerns. They're pointing to an underground copper mine in Indonesia where there was a disaster last year where 28 miners were killed. And they say that some of the people involved with that mine are also involved with Twin Metals, including the current CEO. So Twin Metals officials, they weren't available for comment today after their conference call, but opponents say that track record's a concern.
How did investors react to the study?
Not particularly well. The stock price dropped over 20% today, and it's down about 75% over the past year. Investors today, they appear to have some concerns about Twin Metals' ability to raise the money needed to build this project. It's estimated to cost about $2.7 billion over a three-year construction period. And also last month, Antofagasta, which is a big Chilean mining company and a partner in the project, they announced that they would not exercise an option to buy a majority stake in Twin Metals. So that's also raised some concerns.
And what about the timeline for Twin Metals moving forward?
They still have a lot of work ahead of them to get to the point where PolyMet, for example, is in the process. They'll need to submit a final mine plan to regulators to start the environmental review process, and that's likely at least a year or two away.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome, Stephen.
That's our Duluth reporter, Dan Crocker, who's been following progress of the proposed Twin Metals mining project in northeastern Minnesota.
And that was Stephen John on All Things Considered. Social media has become ubiquitous, but for professionals like teachers, police officers, and doctors, there are ethical issues to consider before sending out a tweet or accepting a friend request. For some, navigating the real and virtual worlds can be a challenge as well as a risk. Reporter Elizabeth Baer tells us how some doctors in Minnesota's own Med City are now embracing social media.
To get a sense of how Rochester's doctors and medical professionals are using social media, I spoke with my own dentist, Kevin Copper. He and his wife own a small practice, and they've taken to Facebook to connect with patients.
And to be honest, there's a set of patients that prefer to contact you about appointments and things just through Facebook, rather than email.
Their practice has a business page, kind of like an ad, with office hours and general business information. But most of the real interaction, the private messages, the liking, the scheduling, all that happens from their personal accounts. Copper says because they're a private practice, those online conversations are extensions of the small talk that happens inside the office. And he emphasizes it's all small talk, nothing that reveals private patient information.
I think people like the personal contact. And we're a small practice. It's just my wife and I and one employee, and you could say there's private things that you should keep private. But honestly, you know, here, you know, when we're working, we generally talk about our lives anyway, so we don't really have anything to hide that way, so I guess it's okay.
Some patients think that's just fine. Matthew Clark is a 30-year-old nursing assistant in Rochester who's friends with the Coppers on Facebook and one of their patients.
We have a lot of stuff in common. We like a lot of the same music. I didn't see it to be a provider-patient conflict. It's not like we hang out outside of it, but, you know, it's just Facebook. It's just Facebook. You know, you don't really get that super close to everyone you're friends with on Facebook.
Clark says virtual connections work for some, but certainly not all medical professionals. In 2009, after he received a heart transplant at Mayo, he wanted to friend his doctors, but he knew he shouldn't.
You have someone save your life. You want to be friends with them. I mean, you want to have interactions with them, and that was a really important person to you, and it's hard to delineate the difference between their taking care of you versus they're your friend.
In the digital age, the biggest concern for doctors is maintaining patient confidentiality. Lee Acey is social media director at Mayo Clinic. The clinic has a social media policy that discourages friending patients online, and it reminds doctors never to practice medicine in public. But Acey says those are professional expectations that shouldn't scare doctors from using platforms like Twitter to interact with patients.
The reality is that the patients and consumers have been online doing these discussions for a really long time. And it's just a matter of whether the professionals join them and provide their perspective and expertise in the discussion as well.
One safe bet, Acey says, is for doctors to let patients follow them first.
That's probably a safer way of doing it, so that way if the patient's initiating it, you're clearly complying with what the patient's interest is, and you know that initiation probably is safer.
The clinic's Center for Social Media has trained about 350 employees in voluntary social media boot camps since 2011. Among them is 31-year-old Angela Matke, a general pediatrician. She stopped using Facebook after some of her patients' parents started to friend her. But in the last year, she's used Twitter to share her expertise to a broader audience, including her young patients' parents.
Your office visit is so short, you know, 15-minute visits for a full well child check. And so this way we can, like, continue the conversation. And they can, you know, I can give them more resources. That way I'm not able to email patients correctly, but this is a way that I could send that information out to them.
Matke says Twitter lets her maintain an appropriate level of distance. She's slowly building her following, sharing links, and joining virtual chats. But she's still cautious about engaging with patients, and she'll never answer patient-specific questions on social media. For that, she says, a doctor's visit will still have to do. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
2,000 people are planning to share a meal in the Frogtown neighborhood of St. Paul next month. The dinner table will take up a half mile of city street. This massive outdoor banquet is the vision of artist Satu Jones. He wants the community meal to spark conversation about healthy eating in a largely low-income neighborhood. In this next installment of our Young Reporters series, Lisa Oyolu has a preview.
Frogtown resident Satu Jones is well known for his public art that encourages community engagement. Often, Jones's work revolves around social issues. This time, he's focusing on food and access to healthy food. On a recent walk through Frogtown, Jones ran into kids from the neighborhood who are learning about that firsthand. Youth Farm teaches gardening skills, and at lunchtime, that can be handy.
What'd you have for lunch?
We had for lunch today some fried chicken, and we had rice. Some vegetables and beans.
Did you guys grow any of that food?
Yes.
Which food did you grow?
All of it.
Okay.
Except the chicken and the rice.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Urban Farms in Frogtown will supply some of the food for the meal. Jones wants to bring attention to healthy eating options in Frogtown, which he believes many of his neighbors are unaware of. He says there were several things that inspired him to organize the dinner.
One was watching this endless parade of people walk by my studio windows here when I open up my blinds that would be going in one direction and then coming back just a few minutes later with bags of groceries, knowing that they had just shopped at the local convenience store. There are other more healthy food choices.
To get ready for the big events, community members are holding small dinners, serving healthy foods, and discussing why they matter. Jones refers to these as food stories, or the great stories of people's lives written in carbohydrates, proteins, and vegetables. Spoken word artists will transform the stories into a performance for the dinner. Jones envisions the meal as an opportunity to combine art, food, and healthy living in a single community event. However, he quickly discovered that he needed a lot of help.
there's no way I could do this by myself. And so we've hired a producer, somebody to coordinate the mobile art kitchens. We've hired a choreographer that will be creating this whole set of movements from the serving stations to the tables for all of the servers. I didn't even think about the logistical nightmare that all of this is presenting.
One of Jones's major partners in this effort is Public Arts St. Paul. The organization's president, Christine Podas-Larsen, has one of the harder jobs. She has to deal with the logistics of the dinner. Public Arts St. Paul has teamed up with local farmers to supply the fresh produce based on their menu.
Well, that meant we had to have a menu, and that was no small feat because everything on the menu somehow has a relationship to someone's food story, whether it's apples or whether it's collard greens or chicken. It's all arising from these food stories.
Many Frogtown residents are excited about the work going into the event. Sam Buffington is the organizing director for the Frogtown Neighborhood Association. He says the dinner is important in reframing how people think of Frogtown.
You know, it's about like seeing the neighborhood in a different kind of way, not as a transit corridor, but as a neighborhood, and that there's people who live here. Just reconnecting to this community and having the folks come together and remind us that as a neighborhood, it's more than just a transit corridor as well.
Buffington hopes this community building effort continues, even after dessert. Ultimately, the dinner is designed to address the barriers to healthy eating in Frogtown. Saytu Jones sees it as an artistic way to start the conversation. In the meantime, he's hitting the streets of Frogtown to make sure his neighbors have a seat at the table.
Not enough folks know about it, so that's why I'm walking with this clipboard in my hand. It's my goal to make sure that at least half of the folks that are seated at that table are people from this neighborhood.
Weather permitting, 2,000 people will sit down for dinner on September 14th. Tickets are available through Public Arts St. Paul. Lisa Oyobu, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update podcast for Thursday, August 21. Back on the 22nd with Minnesota's Friday News.